Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and welcome to the last lecture of Einstein Fest. Not the last event, but the last lecture. Just want to remind you that Professor Eckert, Professor Stachel, and Professor Horowitz will join me at 4 o'clock today for the final American Express Bistro Banter. It is now my great pleasure to introduce Arthur Eckert, the lead Trapnell Professor of Quantum Physics at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at the University of Cambridge, and a professorial fellow at King's College, Cambridge, as well as a distinguished professor at the National University of Singapore. Dr. Eckert received his PhD from Oxford University in 1991, where he pioneered the development of quantum cryptography. Following various postdoctoral fellowships at Oxford, combined with a visiting position at Innsbruck, he became a professor at the University of Oxford, whereupon he moved several years ago in 2002 across the road, as it were, to Cambridge University to take up his present position, combined with a position as Temasek Professor in Singapore University. It should also be added that Professor Eckert, in addition to Professor Steinhardt, whom some of you may have heard yesterday, sits on our scientific advisory committee, and I say this with no sycophancy intended, Arthur has been absolutely wonderful for us to develop the research effort in quantum information theory that both Perimeter Institute and the Institute for Quantum Computing have been able to do in such a relatively short period of time, and Arthur is bears a considerable amount of responsibility, at least positive responsibility, for all that has been accomplished. It is my great pleasure to introduce to all of you Professor Arthur Eckert.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Howard. And I'm very glad to be here in Waterloo. It's always a pleasure to come back and see a few friendly faces. And today, I would like to explain in the simplest possible terms yet another legacy of Albert Einstein. And I'm not going to, in my talk, I'm not going to go to year 1905, this famous Annus Mirabilis, but I will be talking about, I hope I will be talking about, let me just start this thing. All those classical computers, you can never rely on them. I'll be talking about connection between Einstein and secure communication. So this year we make Einstein responsible for just about everything that happened in physics. And so I'll make him responsible for secure communication. I'll make a connection between his 1935 paper that he wrote together with Podolsky and Rosen, and the current development in the art of secure communication and data protection. It is actually very interesting because this 1935 paper was kind of a negative paper. Einstein was very unhappy about quantum mechanics, the way it is formulated, and he thought it was not complete. And he just expressed his worry in this paper together with two colleagues of his, Boris Podolsky and Nathan Rosen. However, as it happened, this negative paper turned out to be a very positive paper, very motivating paper, paper that inspired many physicists to look deeper into the essence of quantum mechanics. And after, a period of worry, there came a period in the 80s and 90s where we stopped that worrying about quantum mechanics and started using it for information processing. So roughly my talk will be on this particular theme. Well, I'm going to start the whole story with cryptography and secure communication. So when I'm going to talk about secure communication, here is a scenario I would like you to have in mind. So we're going to have two characters, Alice and Bob, two goodies, And they want to communicate with each other. They have secrets to share. And there could be a third party involved, an eavesdropper. And the question is it possible for Alice and Bob to communicate in such a way that you exclude eavesdropper from this game? And it's actually quite an old question. So we go back to history and ask how people managed to solve this three-body problem, Alice, Bob, and Eve for eavesdropper. Well, it turns out that people developed all kinds of interesting techniques, and they were based on two basic techniques of permutation of characters or substitution of characters or fusion of those two techniques. So if you want to scramble a written message, you may change a position of characters in the message, and that's permutation, or you may substitute one character with another character. So permutation of characters appeared pretty early, about 400 BC in ancient Greece. Spartans used a device known as a scytale. So here it is, the first known cryptographic device. It's a wooden button of a certain diameter, and you take a strip of parchment and wrap it around, and you can write your message lengthwise like this. Then you unwrap it. As you can see, A is still A, and T is still T, and C is still C somewhere here. But the position of characters is different now. Now, what you can do, you can give this strip of parchment into a courier that would go from one military commander to another military commander in ancient Sparta, and the other guy would have a wooden button of exactly the same size. So when the courier arrives, this military commander would take the parchment, wrap it on, and the message would reappear. So that is the first device that we know about that was used for secure communication, to implement permutation of characters. Well, rumor has it that Julius Caesar, about 50 BC, used another method of secure communication based on substitution of characters. So what he did, if you write an alphabet like this, and you shift the alphabet by three characters to any number of characters, but apparently Julius Caesar shifted it by three, to the left and append this A, B, C to the end, so you can, then you actually come up with a substitution rule. And the substitution rule here says, for A, substitute D, for B, substitute E, for C, substitute F. And this way, you can encrypt the message, the same message that we saw on the previous slide, by the substitution rule. So A becomes D, T, you look where it's T, and then it becomes W, and so on and so forth. So as you can see, the position of the encrypted character is not changed, but the appearance of this character is now different. So that's scrambled in this way. So that's known as a substitution cipher. Now, do you think it's secure? No. Obviously not. Well, this is a very politically correct slide, by the way. You know, as it happens, the person who figured out how to crack substitution ciphers lived and worked in Baghdad in the 9th century, and he's known as Al-Kindi, the philosopher of Arabs. So he wrote a book in the 9th century in which he said, well, you know, with those simple substitutions, you do not change the characteristic of the character. It doesn't matter that you change the visual appearance of the character, but many other attributes of this character are the same. For example, the frequency of appearance of this character. As you see, in any natural language, be it English, Polish, German, Japanese, Chinese, whatever, frequency of characters are not random. In any written text, there is a pattern, and if you substitute one character with another, you do not mess up with this pattern. So, for example, the most frequent character in English is the letter E, and the second most frequent would be letter T. So here is a diagram that shows you the frequency of characters in a typical English text. So then it's quite clear, following that Al-Kindi figured out that If you look for the most frequent character and make a reasonable assumption that it is written in English, and Al-Kindi thought it didn't actually think about English, but say today you know that it was a simple substitution cipher, and you see the most frequent character. However, it doesn't matter how it looks. And you say, obviously, let me make a reasonable assumption that this is the letter E. And then I look at the second most frequent character, that must be the letter T, and so on and so forth. And working this way through the text, through the cryptogram, you can very easily recover the plain text, the message that was hidden by the simple substitution cipher. So it is not very secure. It's trivial to break such a cipher. However, I said it has to be a typical English text, because some writers, just to show off how good they are, can disguise the frequency of characters. And there's even a name for this kind of writing. It's called a lipogram. So if you look, for example, at this text here, and you read it carefully, it kind of reads okay, right? But it is a lipogram. It doesn't have the letter E in it. The most frequent letter is dropped, and it's not easy to write a lipogram. So you may give it a try. Go home and try to write a paragraph, two paragraphs, without using the letter E. And that's extremely difficult. So the most famous lipogram was written by a French chap called Georges Perec, who wrote the whole book, 85,000 words, without the letter E. And by the way, as you probably know, the E is the most frequent letter in French as well. The English translator, Gilbert Avdera, translated the book and succeeded in avoiding the letter E in the translation as well. And on the German side, I was trying to find a good example in English and French and German. On the German side, there was a rather crazy German poet called Berman in the Romantic period. He really loved writing poems without R. So he developed this R-less poetry. And so he wrote 130 poems without using that letter, and you know, he omitted this in daily conversation for 17 years or so. So he probably didn't even mention his name for the 70 years, you see. Right, so now going back to cryptography. So is there such a thing like a perfect cipher? Al-Kindi showed us how to break very simple substitution ciphers. How about a really good cipher? So if we go through history, and this could be a lecture on its own, so I'm not going to spend too much time describing the development of various cryptographic techniques, but if we go through history, there are major breakthroughs every now and then. For example, the invention of polyalphabetic ciphers in the 16th century. So the substitution was not one-to-one, but one-to-many. And then invention of mechanical ciphers in the 20th century using the machines like the Enigma. But all of them, sooner or later, were broken. So if you talk to a historian, they would say, well, whenever you come up with a clever cipher, sooner or later there will be another clever chap who will show you how to break it. So there's probably no such a thing like a truly unbreakable cipher. However, having said this, there is one. And it is known as a one-time path. And people knew about it for some period of time. So the one-time path is a technique where you write your message as a sequence of zeros and ones. It's not encrypted. It is any public substitution that is known. So the groups of zeros and ones would show a frequency of a natural language. So we consider this as a message. So you write your message as a sequence of zeros and ones following any publicly agreed alphabet. And then, if Alice wants to send a message to Bob, she would pick up a string of zeros and ones, completely random, and as long as the message. Now, then she would add this string, the plain text, the message here, to the key, one by one, bit by bit, following the rule that, you know, 0 plus 0 is 0, 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 0 is 1, and 1 plus 1 is 0 in this addition modulo 2, simply because we don't want to go outside the alphabet of zeros and ones. And it's this way you can generate the result of this addition, which is a cryptogram. Now, the beautiful thing is that if this thing here, the key, is truly random, the randomness of the key is transferred to the randomness of the cryptogram. So the key masks any natural pattern that you can find in the plain text. So this thing here is truly random because the key is random. And then, as such, you can send it over any unprotected public channel to well, Alice can send it to Bob, and Bob will pick up the cryptogram, will pick up the key from his secret drawer or secret safe, and will perform the same addition one by one, bit by bit, addition modulo two, and recover the plaintext, exactly the same message that Alice was sending to him. So Claude Shannon managed to show that this cipher that was invented in the 20s, in 1920s, and Shannon in the 50s managed to prove that as long as the key is truly random, whatever that means, and if the key is as long as the message and used only once, then you cannot break this cipher. There's no frequency pattern. There's no pattern here at all that would reveal message in any way. So that's it. We have a perfect cipher. But there is a problem. I've made a tacit assumption, and I hope you can see what kind of assumption I've made here. So any ideas where things can go wrong? Yes? Randomness. Yeah, that is a one possibility, but there's no basic assumption here. Yes? Oh, well, exactly. So the question is, how come both of them, Alice and Bob, end up with the same sequence of zeros and ones? If somehow you can guarantee this, you have a perfect cipher. But a priori, we have to find a method for Alice and Bob to end up with this random sequence of zeros and ones. And mind you, they can be miles away from each other. They have no chance to meet and scribble on a piece of paper secretly in a dark room or whatever. And so the key distribution problem is the big problem for cryptography. So once we can solve the key distribution problem, we can guarantee perfectly secure communication via one-time path. So that's kind of a holy grail of cryptography, the key distribution problem. Mind you, again, please notice that the key is not a message. Key is a completely random, meaningless string of characters. So it doesn't contain any message, but it gives you a possibility, a potential, to communicate secretly later on, because you can use it for meaningful message, for the encryption of the meaningful message. So in some sense, key can be distributed well in advance because they don't contain any message. It's just a completely random sequence of zeros and ones. And the power of the key is that, A, they're random. And by the way, your point about randomness is valid, that the things can go wrong if they're not random. And they are known only to Alice and Bob, so they're truly secret. So one has to guarantee this key security because, of course, if the key is known to the third party, to an eavesdropper, then that's not a very good crypto system. Eve can read all messages between Alice and Bob. Okay, so now I should probably mention that there are two approaches to solving key distribution problem. One is truly mathematical. It's a beautiful piece of mathematics that was proposed in the 70s, known under the label public key crypto system. And I'm not going to talk about them, but I should perhaps mention that this kind of cryptography is not known to be perfectly secure. In fact, we know that the security of public key crypto systems relies on the fact that certain mathematical operations are perceived as difficult, but no one managed to prove that how difficult they really are. Moreover, we know that if one day we build a quantum computer, and I'm going to mention about quantum computers later on, then most public key crypto system will be insecure. So let me just only mention, there is a mathematical solution that is widely used at the moment. But now we are looking at the ultimate security, and it seems that the answer for the ultimate security comes from physics rather than mathematics. In fact, we will now go back to Einstein's 1935 paper, and I'm going to tell you how physicists manage to use quantum phenomena for key distribution, for secure key distribution. So we are going to use a very peculiar quantum phenomenon, which Einstein called the spooky action at a distance, where somehow at two different locations you may generate random numbers which are perfectly correlated. And this was not even invention of Albert Einstein. It was noticed by Erwin Schrödinger, in fact, a little bit before 1935. It's not entirely clear when exactly quantum entanglement as the phenomenon is known, was noticed. Probably in around 1932. In fact, I had a bet with two PhD students of mine, Matthias Christandl and Lawrence Ayonu, about those things. So they traveled to Vienna and looked into old scribblings by Schrödinger, handwritten notes by Schrödinger in the archive of the University of Vienna, and they found what probably is the first indication of Schrödinger's worry, or maybe not worry, but sort of amazement of quantum mechanics, where you somehow have two systems, one and two, that form one entity, even though they may be separated. So I'll come to this in a moment, just to show you a historical note. It seems that quantum entanglement was noticed about 1932. So it was not Einstein who discovered this phenomenon, but Einstein was really baffled by it. And that was his big contribution. Now, now this is the most difficult part, both, I guess, for you if you're not physicists, and for me to explain it well. So I need a little bit of help and concentration on your side. I'm going to simplify things. I'm not going to cheat that much. There will be a little bit of cheating on my side, but I'll try to give you the idea of the essence of quantum entanglement now. To those who know a little bit about quantum mechanics, let me just say that I try to illustrate how to measure different types of polarizations and show that those using a simple analogy of card reading machines. So here is my translation of it. Actually gives you the essence of the idea. So it's and this is by far the most important part of it. So imagine that we can build a machine, a blue machine and a red machine, such that if you have a card, and you can have two types of cards, say green or red, you can put it into the envelope. So those machines can see through the sealed envelopes and read whatever is written on those cards. So for example, a blue machine, like this one, can reliably read blue cards. So if you put something, it will actually see through, and it will always get it right. So if you write a bit value 0 or 1 on a blue card, so blue machine can certainly read blue cards correctly. So here we are again. So now the red machine can read red cards correctly. So if you do this trick, as you can see, whatever goes in is properly read by this machine. However, when I try to use blue machine to read the red card, then the outcome could be truly random. Blue machine is completely hopeless to read red cards. Whatever, if I really put a red card into the envelope and seal it, the blue machine can come up with any outcome whatsoever. And vice versa, a red machine cannot read blue cards correctly. So that's how it goes. So to summarize, we have a situation where we have two types of machines. I can prepare cards, red and blue, and write a bit value on the card, 0 or 1. And I know that if I use blue machine to read the bit value on the envelope, if it was written on the blue card, then I can read it correctly. If it was written on the red card, anything, any random outcome is possible, and vice versa. Now, interesting thing is, though, that having this kind of situation, having this kind of machines reading cards in the way I just described, there are sources of entangled cards. Actually, there are sources of entangled photons, because in this particular case, the red and blue machines correspond to the measurement of two different types of polarization of photon. But roughly, think about it, that the physicists can generate entangled cards. And then, so those, in this particular case, out of a physical process, you have two sealed envelopes. You have cards inside, and they may have bit values written on them, be it 0 or 1. And they can go miles away. One can travel to Alice, and another one can travel to Bob. And then at Alice's location, Alice can choose randomly which particular machine is she going to use to read the card. So somehow, for example, if you think that there is a blue card with a bid value written on it, if Alice is lucky and picks up the blue machine to read the card, she will read the bid value correctly. If she's not lucky and she will pick up the red machine, then she will, and any outcome is possible, she will not read it correctly, and vice versa. However, what was noticed in this kind of experiments is that whenever Alice and Bob use the same type of machine to read cards, the results always agree. And so if both of them, for example, choose blue machines, they always get the right result. So you may say, okay, well, maybe what is going on here is that this source is producing blue cards in the envelopes perfectly correlated. So for example, the source will produce two blue cards with values 0 and 0 or 1, 1 written on them. And those cards, obviously, when they travel to Alice and Bob and they use blue machines, they see perfect correlation. So perhaps there's nothing surprising at that. But you see, the same is going on if they choose to measure cards in the red machines. So then you say, well, okay, well, if only they would measure cards using red machines, then I can explain it by in the same way I was trying to explain correlations with the blue machines, that simply this device, this source, is producing pairs of red cards with correlated bid values written on them. But then the surprising thing is that Alice and Bob can choose randomly which particular machine to use. So sometimes they would use, both of them would use blue machines. Sometimes one of them would be using blue, the other would be using red. Sometimes both of them would be using red. They don't communicate with each other. For each incoming envelope, they choose which particular machine they want to use. And nonetheless, without communicating anyway, later on, they just, when they compare data, they realize that somehow, whenever they use the same type of the machine, be it both blue or both red, the results always agreed. So how can you possibly explain this, knowing how those machines act? And you may try. You may try to think about it this way, the other way. The one thing is that somehow, and that is something that Einstein really truly worried about, it looks like it doesn't work if you assign any particular color or any particular bit value to the card inside the envelope prior to the measurement. So it feels a little bit like the results of the measurements are not revealing pre-existing values of colors and bit values, but somehow measuring devices create them. But then how can they create them in such a way they are perfectly correlated if those devices are miles away? Well, if you assume that there's no immediate communication between one device or the other, you're really stuck. So Einstein didn't like it at all. He thought, well, it doesn't make much sense. It's against simple understanding of nature, where objects have properties can be measured, and measurements reveal pre-existing values of those properties. They don't make them up, they just reveal what is there prior to measurement. And it seems that quantum mechanics doesn't quite work this way. So this paper that he wrote in 1935 referred to this kind of experiment, saying that, well, you know, I want nature to be described by a theory that is local, and that has element of reality, that means that measurements kind of discover pre-existing values of things. So that was his frustration with quantum mechanics. So the title of the paper suggests that quantum mechanics may not be complete. Maybe there's a better explanation for what's going on. Well, let's leave Einstein for a moment. Somehow his work was not that much, of course, he debated with Niels Bohr, And you know, he was saying, well, God doesn't play dice, and Borset stopped telling God what to do, and so on and so forth. And at the end of the day, I don't think it was resolved in any way, until in the 60s, where John Bell said, well, look, forget about Gedanken experiment and simple ideas. I can come up with a really testable experiment, which was a slightly more sophisticated version of the experiment I was describing. And this experiment can really tell the difference between local realism, so where the quantum mechanics works in the way Einstein would like it to work, or otherwise. So you can make a real experiment, you can set up experiment that will somehow distinguish between two different approaches to description of nature. And as I say, this particular experiment was not that much different from what I was describing. And the thing is that sometime later, a series of experiments were set up and performed. And probably the most known one is by Alain Aspect in Paris, who in the early 80s actually, in a rather convincing way, showed that local realism is refuted. That whether we want this or not, the quantum mechanics is weird. And somehow, it doesn't make sense to assign pre-existing values to and pre-existing colors to those cards in the envelopes. Now, at this point, you may wonder, okay, but what has to do with cryptography? Well, actually, a lot. And certainly for me, it was very interesting to read this paper, 1935 paper, because when I was reading this paper and I was reading how Einstein was trying, first of all, to define what does it mean that there is a pre-existing value. So he was trying to define the element of reality. And so here's a quotation from this paper. So he says, if without in any way disturbing a system, we can predict with certainty the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this physical quantity. So in this case, you know, we want to know whether there is a pre-existing zero or one on the envelope, or is there a polarization that encodes zero and one. And if you read this again and again, and you think about information security, then you realize that this reads as a definition of perfect eavesdropping. That is exactly what an eavesdropper would like to do. To be able to learn about the value of a physical property without disturbing it in any way, without messing it up. And that a local realism would allow you to do this. But quantum mechanics refuted, is not local, it doesn't follow local realism, local realism was refuted. So therefore, entangled photons do not have predetermined values of polarization, entangled cards do not have predetermined values of bit values written on them. So eavesdropper has really nothing to measure. In some sense, there's nothing there when those particles are in transit from the source to Alice and Bob. There's really nothing there to be measured. Somehow the measurements happen in the devices that Alice and Bob prepare at their location. Whether you want to take this view or not, it seems that it just goes this way. So quantum mechanics does allow eavesdropping free communication. And in fact, probably any post-quantum theory, so say, suppose one day quantum mechanics is refuted, but local realism is refuted as well. So most likely, the new theory will also allow secure communication. So the history I described here is kind of an approach to quantum cryptography, my sort of personal approach to quantum cryptography. I have to say that that mine is not the only one. In fact, earlier than that my approach in 1991, Stephen Wiesner thought about a different approach to secure communication using the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and that was later on developed into a quantum cryptosystem by Charlie Bennett and Gilles Brassard. However, those two approaches that were developed independently from each other are in many ways complementary in the sense that that these days, quite often, you analyze cryptosystem based on prepare and measure technique developed by Wiesner Bennett and Brassard using entanglement-based protocols, and you can use some ideas from prepare and measure protocols to analyze security of entanglement-based protocols. Now that's the history, and today quantum cryptography evolved from a wacky idea, as it was at the very beginning, to serious experimental physics, and even to a commercial proposition. So these days you can in fact buy quantum crypto systems, and you can see that, you know, quantum cryptography actually competes on the cover of Newsweek with David Beckham. So if you compete with Beckham on the cover of Newsweek, it means more or less you made it, right? Well, there's much more to entanglement. I just told you about one particular story, how Einstein is indirectly responsible for secure communication. But there's much more to entanglement, and one can talk about quantum computers, how entanglement enters the new generation of computing devices that hopefully we will be able to build in not too distant future, and how it is responsible for new algorithms, new complexity classes, frequency standards, atomic clocks, and many, many other things. Somehow, what we see today, apart from quantum cryptography, which is the most mature part of quantum information science, we see this amazing fusion of computer science and physics, quantum physics in particular. And it's amazing coincidence that they were developed more or less at the same time. So you can see Alan Turing here in Cambridge in about 1935, and Albert Einstein in Princeton around 1935, working on what looked like completely different intellectual endeavors. And nonetheless, they ended up a few years later, well, 70 years later or so, we now see how the two are so much complementary, so how much we can get out of the fusion of those two bodies of knowledge that were developed more or less at the same time. Well, if I were to conclude this and maybe answer the question, why is it so that physicists managed to answer some questions in computer science and in cryptography, which mathematicians found difficult? I mean, I'm not trying to be dismissive about mathematics. I'm just saying that there are certain problems that somehow physicists managed to solve, like the key distribution problem, like many other problems in computer science. I guess the answer is physicists managed to solve those problems because they look at information processing as a real physical process. For physicists, a computer is a physical device. Key distribution problem is done by physical carriers of information that have certain physical properties. And one way to illustrate this is perhaps to give you a puzzle. I'll give you the answer to this puzzle as well, so don't worry. The puzzle goes like this. So here you are, this little Microsoft man, and you are in front of two rooms. On the right, there's a room with three electric switches. On the left, there's a room with three light bulbs. You know that there's one-to-one connection, correspondence between light bulbs and the switches. And your task is to find about this one-to-one correspondence, but you are allowed to enter each room only once. So once you're in a room, you can do whatever you want. Once you leave the room, you cannot go back to the same room. Now, of course, you cannot see what's going on in the other room. From this one, you cannot see what's going on in the other. Now, can you solve this problem? Now, if you think as a mathematician, you may say, well, probably not. Because, you know, those switches are initially in position off. If I go to this room first, what can I do? I can put the first switch in position on, but then if I go to the other room, I can see that one light bulb is on, but there's ambiguity about the two that are off. So that's not good enough. Well, what else can I do? I can put perhaps two switches in position on. But then, of course, if I go to the other room, there's ambiguity about the two light bulbs which are on. So that's not good enough. However, if you think about this problem again, and you think this is for real, this is not an abstract problem. This is, imagine you're really there. So most experimental physicists have no problem whatsoever to solve this. Well, they say, well, of course I can solve this problem. What I do, I go to this room first. I put the first switch in position on. I go to the second switch. I put it in position on, say, for 5 minutes, and I switch it off. Then I go to this room. One light bulb is on. One is warm, and the other one is off. So what happened in physics or in computer science is that somehow when we think about computers as physical devices, and when we make progress in understanding nature, then of course we can do more and we can solve problems that were not that easy or were difficult or even impossible to solve. So this heat dissipation here is like quantum mechanics. It's sort of extra possibility, extra, you have one extra tool to play with. So that, I guess, is probably what is going on now. So we discover quantum mechanics, we see how powerful it is. We look at some problems, more like from a physicist's point of view, and we see, hey, it's interesting, we can solve things now that we couldn't solve before, because quantum mechanics offers you extra possibilities. And I should perhaps add that this area is quantum information science is a growing area, and there are many young good researchers involved in this field, and there's a very strong group in Waterloo working on this kind of problems. And if you think about going to science and think about physics or mathematics, let me just invite you to join this community to investigate it further. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Eckert, for a wonderful talk. At this point, we have a little bit of time for questions. So if for those of you who are interested in asking questions, please put up your hand. And we have our roving individuals with microphones to take your questions. There's a question right here. Please wait for the microphone to come to you.
Thank you very much. Professor, I'm interested if, in your opinion, the whole issue of quantum entanglement is a restatement of the Schrodinger's cat paradox. You're aware of that that thought of that Gedanken experiment he made, whereby a signal is sent, but one doesn't know at point of reception what it is until one expects it, and then the act of inspection seems to make the Schrodinger equation collapse, and reality occurs as a result of your inspection. He imagined this being linked to a vial of poisonous gas. And the cat would be poisoned if the quantum signal were in one direction, zero, for instance, the cat's life would end. And if it were one, then the cat would continue to exist.
Well, yes, so there's, of course, the Schrodinger. Well, I'm destroying the property of Parameter Institute, Howard, I'm sorry. I'm just, yes, that's the last lecture. Well, going back to this question, so actually the Schrodinger cat paradox is not that much based on entanglement, but another puzzling phenomenon in quantum physics, which is a notion of superposition. So the fact that one object can coexist in two different states, like in this particular case, your cat being alive or dead at the same time. So it is related to quantum entanglement. It's a different phenomenon, though. And do we have a good resolution of this paradox today? And the answer is no. We are keen to play with more and more macroscopic superpositions. No one is in physics surprised that a photon can be in two different locations at this, one photon can be in two different locations at the same time. So the superposition at the micro level is kind of accepted. What we find difficult to accept is a notion of a quantum superposition at the macro level. And so therefore it's fascinating to see how physicists are trying to prepare quantum superpositions of more and more complicated and complex objects. However, by doing so, we don't see anything wrong with quantum mechanical predictions, but conceptual explanation, what is really going on, is somewhat, there's a variety of opinion. Some people say, well, there must be another equation that is responsible for collapse, that we see that either this cat is alive or dead, and there are some researchers who are looking for this different physical process. And there are some who say, well, maybe there's no extra equation of motion for this. Maybe just everything, maybe indeed the cat is both alive and dead, but somehow the reality for this cat splits. So there's a so-called many-world or Everett interpretation of quantum physics. So it depends very much which particular religion in quantum mechanics you choose. And I'm agnostic, so I'm not going to... Well, actually, I'm not. I have my own, but I will not tell you.
We have another question over here. Before, just as you come to the microphone, a common remark that people make is that this experiment, to the best of my knowledge, was never actually performed, and no actual cats died in any thought experiment. Just protect us from the animal rights groups here.
One of the problems with the practical applications of quantum cryptography seems to be the limited distances over which messages can be transmitted. What are the future prospects for overcoming that problem?
Yes, thank you. Well, indeed, the thing is that this quantum entanglement can be only propagated over a certain distance, which is usually today, I would say 20, 30 kilometers, but maybe not more. There are two ways to increase this distance. One is by building what is known as quantum repeaters. So those are devices that you somehow send to entangle particles to two different stations, and then those stations will relay quantum entanglement. Oh, more precisely, it is actually like this. So you have several sources of entangled particles along a transmission line. So suppose there are two. And then you bring together each element of pair from two entangled pairs into a device called quantum repeaters and perform a measurement which makes the other two entangled. So you can swap entanglement over longer distances. And it's actually a very... The device itself is complicated, but not too complicated. We'll probably have quantum repeaters long before we have quantum computers. And several researchers are working on quantum repeaters at the moment. So that's one way to do it. And of course, another way is to make sure that attenuation is as low as possible if you propagate your photons in optical fibers or free optical space. So that requires to work on sources of entangled photons that are tuned to the frequencies or wavelengths, which are good for, say, optical fibers. You would be looking for entangled photons at 1.3, 1.5 microns. And then you want to improve photodetectors as much as possible to get a reasonable count rate. So that's the first one is kind of intelligent way to go, and probably the best way to go in long term. The second one is a brute force push in technology that will allow you to increase the distance. Just, you know, I'm sure that we increase the distance from early experiments, which were over the distance of a few meters, to now 30, 40 kilometers, which is already okay. It's okay for applications like, say, in the city of London, if you want to have a secure communication, everything is within the radius of 30 kilometers or so that's okay. But it will be, of course, nice to be able to distribute over longer distances. Oh, okay, there's also a third way I should have mentioned. There's a satellite distribution, and in fact, there is a European project where you would like to put either entangled source on a satellite that would emit entangled particles and two stations can tune to them. So that's another way, perhaps, to go.
There's a question way up at the back over there.
I was just wondering if perhaps you could shed a little light on the idea of how quantum entanglement leads to the idea that reality is non-local.
So the question is to elaborate on how quantum entanglement leads to the idea that reality is non-local?
Yeah, from what I understand, that one follows the other.
Well, the entanglement made Einstein puzzled about two aspects. One is this element of reality, whether those values are there prior to measurement. So that's one thing. Another one is non-locality. Because in principle, one can somehow think about explanation for quantum mechanical experiments if you assume that there's immediate communication between measuring devices. So if one measurement happens, then somehow this measuring device can communicate the outcome of the measurement to the other device. And that, you know, there are experiments that show that, that doesn't seem to be working this way. So in quantum mechanics, you have a choice to either believe in reality, the objective, the upper existing value, or choose another option. So there is just to think, well, I just go for non-locality. So there are ways to save reality at the expense of non-locality and vice versa. And but it seems that you can come with physical theories which are realistic, that have pre-existing values, but then they assume they're non-local. They assume immediate communication between observers. So quantum entanglement challenges you to come up with explanation that is both gives you the realistic value prior to measurement and a theory that doesn't allow you for instantaneous communication. But we cannot come. All local hidden variable theorems, as they are called, are refuted. So I don't know whether I really answered your question, but what I want to say is that you can have a realistic explanation which is then non-local. If you want to have a local explanation, then there's a problem with realism, with pre-existing values in this experiment. So it goes both ways. And there's no better way of dealing with that apart from quantum mechanics itself, which in this sense is kind of non-local, but doesn't necessarily allow you immediate communication.
We have time for one more question. Oh, your hand is down. Okay.
I'm wondering if what we've heard about extra dimensions in string theory allow a sort of a loophole by which something could be non-local in three dimensions and somehow local in some of the others?
Maybe. I wouldn't. I'm. I don't know. There are approaches like. If you assume the existence of multiverse or many worlds, there are approaches which would save locality. It doesn't have to go to the string theory, but there is, of course, a possibility of rewriting quantum mechanics altogether in some of different ways, and maybe this will happen. Simply, we do not have any better theory at the moment. And quantum mechanics is difficult to refute because all predictions are just fine. We do not have any conflict with any experiment whatsoever. It's just at the conceptual level, we are a little bit uneasy about it. Although I have to say that this worrying period in quantum mechanics that started with Einstein and Bohr and lasted till maybe John Bell and sort of older generation of physicists, it's probably over. Either we got used to quantum mechanics and do not ask those questions anymore and just use the quantum weird things for quantum information, or maybe we understand it better. I don't know. I think that's probably like we got used to it and therefore we think we understand it.
That seems like a very good time to end. At this point, I would like to thank our speaker again for a very informative and stimulating talk. Thank you.